This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Former Vice President Al Gore won an Oscar for his 2006 documentary about global warming, An Inconvenient Truth. Today, Al Gore picked up another award, the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize. He shares the award with the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which, like Gore, was honored for drawing attention to global warming. The award cites the connection between peace, political stability, and global warming, stating, quote, "Extensive climate changes may alter and threaten the living conditions of mankind. There may be increased danger of violent conflicts and wars. The Nobel Committee is seeking to contribute to a sharper focus on the world's future climate and thereby to reduce the threat to the security of mankind. Action is necessary now." Unquote. Within hours after Gore won the Peace Prize, supporters of the Draft Gore movement were quoted saying this might spur Gore into making a late entry in the Democratic race for 2008. Political analysts, though, say that's unlikely, given the logistics and fundraising needs, and Gore's camp just as quickly refuted it. Terry Gross spoke to Al Gore last year when his book and movie about global warming, An Inconvenient Truth, had just been released.
Al Gore, welcome back to Fresh Air. You know, at the beginning of the movie, you say that you've been trying to tell this story about global warming for a long time and that you feel as if you failed to get the message across. Why was it so difficult as a politician to get the message across?
Well, Terry, I think there are several reasons. First, it's a complex issue. When you boil it all down, it's fairly simple, but it does have a lot of moving parts, and the complexity by itself is an obstacle. Secondly, there's a natural tendency to avoid thinking about subjects that might involve some psychic pain and the idea that human civilization is colliding with the Earth's environment is a painful reality. And third, it's a new reality. Nothing in our history or culture prepares us for the new reality, the new relationship between human civilization and the planet's ecosystem. We've quadrupled our population globally in the last 100 years, and we've magnified the power of our technologies thousands of times over. And when you combine those two elements, 6.5 billion people times incredibly powerful ways of exploiting nature, and then you mix in a new philosophy of discounting the future consequences of present actions, it produces this new collision that the most dangerous part of which is global warming. And so it's hard to absorb it, but I think it is now beginning to sink in. I think people are coming to grips with it, and I'm actually becoming optimistic that we're going to respond in time.
Over the years, when you were in politics, you were sometimes mocked for your environmental positions. George H.W. Bush called you Ozone Man and said if the Clinton-Gore ticket won, we'll be up to our neck in owls and out of work. Are there other ways that you think the issue was spun over the years to make environmentalists and people who are interested in reversing the effects of global warming seem like kooks?
Sure. And that's another reason that it has been difficult to communicate the truth, the inconvenient truth, if you will, about this planetary emergency. And that is that some interests, political, business, and otherwise, and ideological, strongly resist the truth here, have used every means at their disposal to confuse people, to put out misinformation, much in the way the tobacco industry tried to confuse people about the scientific linkage after the Surgeon General's report in 1964 showing that smoking cigarettes causes lung disease. They were able to confuse people about the validity of that science and continue the pattern of abuse for almost 4 decades. And basically the same thing has been going on now. And the disinformation, the ridicule, the intentional confusion, all that's part of a political strategy.
Let me mention a study that you cite in your documentary and in your book, An Inconvenient Truth. And this is a study from the University of California at San Diego. A scientist there named Dr. Naomi Oreskes published in Science Magazine a study of every peer-reviewed journal article on global warming from the previous 10 years. And in her random sample of 928 articles, she found that no articles disagreed with the scientific consensus on global warming. Then another study of articles on global warming that were published in the previous 14 years in the press, specifically published in the New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times, and Wall Street Journal, found that more than half of those stories gave equal weight to the scientific consensus and to the view that human beings played no role in global warming. So just to sum up, the scientific journals, the scientists agreed about global warming, but in these four major American newspapers, equal weight was given in half the articles to the opposing view that human beings are not causing global warming. So what does that say to you? How do you interpret that?
Well, it's astonishing. It illustrates the vulnerability of our marketplace of ideas, our public conversation, if you will, to manipulation by the kinds of techniques that were innovated early in the 20th century and were labeled propaganda. They're more sophisticated now. They're part of corporate PR strategies. They have been refined. And the nature of the news media has also changed, not in all media, but in a lot. And as a result, I think we're more vulnerable to this kind of manipulation. I think we've seen it in other areas as well. Before the vote on the Iraq War, 77% of the American people genuinely believed that it was Saddam Hussein who was responsible for hijacking the planes and flying them into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon and in Pennsylvania. And there have been times in our past when we've been vulnerable to being misled over an extended period, but not like now. And when there's a very well-funded, determined, unethical corporate campaign of disinformation, it can have a much larger impact on the impressions put into the minds of the American people than is healthy in a democracy.
When you were running for the presidency in 2000, did your advisors warn you against talking about global warming in your campaign?
Well, you know, some have written that took place. My view of that is slightly different. It wasn't a warning. It was their feeling that every single news cycle every day should be focused on whatever issue would get the most traction. If you will, the most response and move the needle in the horse race of the election. And in spite of that, I insisted on continuing to address this issue. But I have to say that in one respect, they were tactically correct, because often when I would discuss the issue, the formal presentation would be completely ignored in favor of some response during a Q&A afterwards on whatever the horse race issue of the day was. And over time, that inevitably led to them saying, well, look, you know, we tried this, we tried that, and that's ignored. And remember, this was at a time when, more than half of all the news articles were saying this issue may not even be real. And B, my opponent, then Governor Bush, had publicly pledged to regulate CO2, and therefore the perception, I mean, a pledge that was broken immediately after the inauguration, but the perception during the contest itself was that there wasn't that much contrast. Here was a so-called compassionate conservative who said he cared a lot about global warming and had pledged to legally force the reductions of greenhouse gases, and therefore, why would that be a fit issue for covering the campaign conflict? So, to that extent, it was difficult to have a full blown contrast presented in the press.
I guess I'm wondering if you've lost faith in the political system when it comes to global warming, if you think that there are certain issues like global warming that just have no sticking power in the political world until years and years and years later. Because you were talking earlier about how it was a very difficult issue to communicate during the 2000 election. Now you're going back to the very beginning of your political career and talking about how difficult it was to communicate that issue then, even when you had, you know, a leading scientific expert talking about it. So is politics a bad arena to talk about an issue like this?
Hmm. It's a tough arena. I haven't lost faith, though. Because I believe, and from my experience, I feel as if I know that the political system shares one thing in common with the climate system. It's nonlinear. It can appear to move at a glacier's pace, and then after crossing a tipping point, it can suddenly move rapidly into a completely new pattern. I've seen that happen. And when enough people absorb this message, and understand it and feel the sense of urgency that it demands, they will in turn demand that politicians in both parties react accordingly. And I think that there will come a time when our political system does cross a tipping point. And in that sense, I still have faith that we will respond. It's just taken 30 years longer than I thought it would.
In your political career, you were criticized often for, you know, rightly or wrongly, for being stiff, for not being as communicative and as lively as you might have been. Your reviews for this movie, the ones I've seen, largely have been very positive, both in terms of the larger issues that you talk about, but also in terms of your presentation. You've been praised for being lively and funny and engaging, a different evaluation of you than you typically got, for instance, in your 2000 campaign. So what do you think has changed?
Well, I benefit from low expectations. but I think that there are two reasons for the comments that you're referring to. Number one, I think that in a political campaign, particularly a campaign for president, the way a candidate's perceived is shaped by the constant attacks by the opposing side, shaped by the healthy skepticism that viewers and listeners bring to anything that somebody asking for votes is saying, and shaped also by the necessities of a campaign, which really don't allow you to speak about only one issue, but require you to necessarily speak about the full range of concerns that the American voters have a right to hear your views on, and when you move from one to the other, that's a different kind of presentation. But I think there's a second reason for the comments you mentioned, and that is I have been through a lot in the last 6 years, and the old cliche that what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, I think is sometimes true, and all of us learn and grow and evolve and our lives, and you know, your interviews are. I'm sure you've got a lot of listeners who contrast the interviews you do now with ones you did when you first started, and find new texture and depth, and you know, that's part of just living our lives.
You've traveled around different parts of the world looking at the symptoms of global warming. What's the most disturbing thing that you've seen in those travels?
The melting of the North Pole is one of the most urgent catastrophes that should be prevented as quickly as we can convince people to act. It's a fairly thin floating ice cap, and as you know, the Arctic and the Antarctic are very different. The Arctic is ocean surrounded by land, while the Antarctic is land surrounded by ocean, and that makes all the difference in the thickness of the ice. It's 10,000 feet thick in the Antarctic and less than 10 feet thick in the Arctic, much less now. We've lost 40% of it in the last 40 years. And when the ice there melts, there's a dramatic change in the relationship of the surface of the Earth there to the sun. The ice reflects 90% of the incoming sun's energy like a mirror, but the open seawater, after it melts, absorbs 90%, and that's a phase change. It sets up a positive feedback loop that magnifies and speeds up the melting process. And the North Polar ice cap is in grave danger now. And nearby, the great ice mound of Greenland is under increasing pressure from growing temperatures also. If that were to melt, it would, or to break up and slip into the sea, it would raise sea level 20 feet worldwide. The West Antarctic ice shelf that on the other end of the planet, at the other pole, is the part of Antarctica propped up against islands that allow it to be affected by the warming ocean, but also allow it to raise sea level by 20 feet again if it melts or breaks up and slides into the ocean. And these are the three areas that many scientists point to as affecting a so-called point of no return, which we need to avoid, because if we cross that point of no return, then the process of a downward spiral would be irretrievable. So we have to stop short of that.
Al Gore speaking to Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2006 interview with Al Gore. Today he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts to draw attention to global warming. That was the subject of his 2006 film, An Inconvenient Truth, which won the Oscar as Best Documentary Feature.
You were recently on Saturday Night Live. I'm sure a lot of our listeners saw this. And you were on as the president in a parallel universe, where you were actually the 43rd president, and you were delivering a speech from the Oval Office about how we've reversed global warming, how we're dealing with our huge budget surplus, and how much the rest of the world loves America. In fact, let me just play a little clip from Saturday Night Live. This is Al Gore.
In the last 6 years, we have been able to stop global warming. No one could have predicted the negative results of this. Glaciers that once were melting are now on the attack. As you know, these renegade glaciers have already captured parts of Upper Michigan and Northern Maine, but I assure you, we will not let the glaciers win. Right now, in the second week of May 2006, we are facing perhaps the worst gas crisis in history. We have way too much gasoline. Gas is down to 19 cents a gallon, and the oil companies are hurting. I know that I am partly to blame by insisting that cars run on trash. I am therefore proposing a federal bailout to our oil companies because, hey, if it were the other way around, you know the oil companies would help us.
Al Gore, do you sometimes play the what-if game? And do you sometimes play the game of how the world might have been different if you had become president in 2000?
Only in an alternate universe.
But seriously, do you think about that a lot? Do you play that game?
No, I don't. and if you were in my situation, I doubt you would either. It's just a lot healthier to look forward and try to focus on the positive things that that lie ahead. And you know, it was a difficult experience, but not so much for me as it was for the millions of people who were negatively affected by the policies that had been put in place because of that election. But I made a choice to uphold the rule of law after the Supreme Court decision. In our system, there's no intermediate step between a final Supreme Court decision and violent revolution. And so I made a decision to support the rule of law and then to go on with my life and try to find ways to live a positive and useful life. And I'm pleased to have been able to find ways to serve in other ways. And I'm enjoying them. I've started a couple of businesses that are quite fulfilling for me, teaching some. Most of my time is spent delivering my slideshow and speaking on the climate crisis, and it's an increasing part of my time.
Al Gore, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Al Gore, speaking to Terry Gross last year. Earlier today, he was awarded the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air.